Welcome to the Leadership Podcast Series with your host, William Corliss of Yellowwood, in association with Enterprise Ireland. This is a series of podcasts focusing on leadership development for business leaders who want to lead better and scale faster. Hear from subject matter experts and thought leaders offering different perspectives on strategy, leadership, culture, and new emerging business trends. Enterprise Ireland, in collaboration with Yellowwood, bringing best-in-class insights for you, your team, and organization. Keep tuned for monthly updates on www.enterprise-ireland.com.
Welcome to the Workplace Podcast. Joining us today is Frances Fry. Frances is a professor of technology and operations management at Harvard Business School. Her research investigates how leaders create the conditions for organizations and individuals to thrive by designing for excellence in strategy, operations, and culture. She regularly advises organizations embarking on large-scale change initiatives, including embracing diversity and inclusion, as a lever for significantly improving performance. A global thought leader on leadership and strategy, Frances is widely recognized for her breakthrough scholarship and high-impact teaching. She developed one of the most popular classes at HBS, which explores business models that reliably delight customers. She also led the design and launch of HBS's innovative field curriculum built around learning experiences that are experiential and immersive. Frances and her co-author Anne Morris recently launched Fixable, a breakthrough leadership advice podcast from the TED Audio Collective that helps guest callers solve workplace problems. In 30 minutes or less on Fixable, Frances and Anne diagnose callers' leadership challenges and help them make progress with quick, actionable coaching. Frances holds a PhD in operations and information management from Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. She's been recognized by Thinkers 50 as among the world's most influential business thinkers. Thank you for listening to the Workplace Podcast. Our topic today is fixing things fast. And I'm joined by one very talented person, Professor Frances Fry. Welcome to the Workplace Podcast.
Oh, I'm so thrilled to be here. Thank you so much.
I was showing you the book, and I must congratulate you and your writing partner, Anne Morris. Move Fast and Fix Things, the Trusted Leader's Guide to Solving Hard Problems. This is such a brilliant book. And the reason why it's so good is that it's basically a playbook on change management and all the different aspects. And I was looking at this, and as you can see here, there's lots of stickies and different notes I was making. I've highlighted so many aspects of that. And before we talk about the book, then I want to congratulate you on being awarded once again a place in the Thinkers Top 50. Congratulations to yourself and Anne.
Oh, thank you so much. That is a very meaningful recognition to us. It's a wonderful community, and we're very excited to be a part of it.
And if people aren't aware of what Thinkers 50 is, what is Thinkers 50?
So it's a group that they, among other things, they nominate the top 50 business thinkers in the world. But it's really a community that comes together and celebrates and cherishes thought leadership in the management space. So as an example, for the second time in a row, and they do this every other year, Amy Edmondson is the number one Thinkers 50. And your listeners, if you haven't heard of Amy Edmondson, just pick up anything that she's written and you'll realize the absolute gigantic influence she has had on the world. Number two is Adam Grant. Like, so your listeners will probably have heard of these folks. Well, they go all the way down to 50, thank goodness, or otherwise Anne and I wouldn't be on it.
It is great to have you here. And then I just realized that we have Amy Edmondson on here in a couple of weeks' time as well.
I'm delighted to be Amy Edmondson's warm-up. Delighted.
Brilliant. So speaking of the book, this is such an easy read. So better still, if you're a manager or a leader and you're overwhelmed with the amount of problems to be tackled at work, you break it down of what you do each day. So we'll go through that in a second. And what's really impressive then, you name check a lot of the companies and organizations you have worked with that faced immense challenges. So can you name some of those companies then, so our listeners might be aware of the challenges that they've overcome?
Yeah. So I think the one that's probably most recognized is when I left my full-time position at Harvard and joined, I took a leave of absence and joined Uber full-time in the spring of 2017, which was when they were going through a very public crisis. And so we helped turn them around. I mean, we were part of it, but there were other magnificent people, but we were part of that. And then we've also, the ones that are publicly, because we don't name everyone, but other ones that are public, we helped Riot Games, which is an amazing gaming organization. And we were also in a public crisis. Interestingly, we were working with WeWork before they had a public crisis. And then that was one that they have just recently, I think, filed for bankruptcy. And we worked with them only for six months in that part of it. But what I would say is that we are, half of our work is firefighting. Half of our work is fire prevention and accelerating excellence. Now, it used to be three quarters firefighting. It's now 50-50. And our ambition is that the amount of firefighting just goes down further and further and further, because in a perfect world, we're not fighting fires because we will have prevented them. So we believe in preventative work. And so that's where our real interest is now. But if you find yourself in a crisis, we know how to help you get out of it.
That's what I liked about this book. On Monday, you invite the reader to identify your real problem. On Tuesday is solving for trust. On Wednesday, making new friends. Thursday, tell a good story. And Friday, go as fast as you can. So we're going to break that down here. So when people think of change, there's a change management initiatives. There might be some people who might be allergic to that, saying, oh, not another initiative. I've change fatigue, or ignore that. It's flavor of the month, or there's a whole slew of, like, what are the responses from people?
Well, my response to that is the same as your readers. Like, they take a long time, they accomplish very little, and you just start to get conditioned to thinking you're going to just wait it out. Just wait it out, and the next one will come. And most change management, most change efforts fail, I think, because they go much too slowly, and they are not nearly ambitious enough. And so what our position is figure out a real problem of consequence, that, like, the world will be different if you solve it. And then let's do that right. Let's solve that well. You won't have any change fatigue for that. But anytime somebody says, oh, we're going to change and change takes a long time, oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. That's just a very big sign that it's not going to go well.
And a statistic that you share in the book, that 70% of organizational efforts fail. So if that's the case, why do we bother at all? Is that piece you were talking about too slow?
Yeah, well, it's knowable how to do it well and how not to. So we should do it correctly, and we should stop doing it incorrectly. So again, if you have a change initiative that's going to take years, please stop. Let us just give you license to stop. It's not going to work, because other things are going to become more important along the way. So we find there's two things. Most organizations are not responding fast enough to problems of consequence. They're not doing it out of fear that they might end up being reckless if they respond too quickly. So there is this unnatural fear of this recklessness, the move fast and break things world. And that world, that really gave change, we think, a bad name, because it the move fast and break things, what we call reckless disruption, it posited that you could either go fast or you could take care, one or the other. And so people who wanted to take care thought, well, I have to go slowly. And the truth is, meaningful change doesn't happen slowly. Meaningful change only happens quickly, but you can go fast and take care. And so that's why we wrote the book, to show you how to do it the 30% way, reliably, and give everybody access to doing it the right way as opposed to the wrong way, which we're probably all enduring right now. Right now, we're all enduring some kind of slow change process that's not going to make any difference in our organization.
Your organization, then, when the listener is listening in, you have a quadrant that best describes your organization. So you have responsible stewardship, accelerating excellence, inevitable decline, and reckless disruption. So tell our listeners about that.
So if you want to go fast, if you go fast and you don't take care, you'll be in reckless disruption. And that's move fast and break things. What we're doing is saying you can go fast and take care, and that's accelerating excellence. So those that are afraid of reckless disruption, the response isn't go slow. The response is take care. So that's, I think, what we want to change. Now, so many people are in responsible stewardship, which is going slowly and taking care. That is the opportunity cost. Like when you're facing a problem of consequence and you go slowly in the face of it, you're communicating something about your values. Your values are the problem is bad, but not bad enough for us to have a enhanced metabolic rate. So Anne and I often think that this book is to help increase the metabolic rate of organizations.
You go to the book, and I'm looking at the book, and there's so many useful resources. So one of the resources then are Monday morning questions. What are the kind of questions that we need to be asking ourselves? So this is at the start of the book. And when you go through those, then you talk about capacity, you talk about culture, you talk about strategy, and you talk about your people and all those different elements. What are the questions we need to be asking ourselves? Because it's really about understanding, am I solving the right problem, isn't it? Like, you're very good at your data and asking the right questions at the very start.
Yeah. So we find that when we would go into organizations and we would try to help them solve for the right problem, they just didn't know where to begin. And so we were like, okay, here's where to begin. So we give you a page and a half of questions organized in the categories you just said, but you don't have to think beyond that. So if you can collect this information, it will be more than you need. And so that was one thing for, if you know where to begin, you don't have to worry about this. But people who were like, I just don't know where to begin, we have to have some idea about from your existing data, about the value propositions you have, about your people, about your culture. Like, we're just asking questions that it's really harnessing what you already know in the organization so that we can productively use that going forward. And it's a very pragmatic book. So we got it down to the simplest set of questions we could. So if you'll notice in that page and a half of questions, every question is answerable. And it's all sort of put in there. And we did that to help people realize, oh my gosh, I could get started right now.
There are elements of the book, and it's about your context then of your organization. What are the signs that organizations might be stalling then? So if there's a high turnover, or
I mean the number one sign that your organization is stalling is when somebody says, oh, that's a big problem, let me give it a task force, and that task force is going to meet every other week for 9 months. You're done. Just don't sign up for that task force, because the task force doesn't have any real decision rights. They just have convening rights, and there's no metabolic rate associated with it. So the number one sign that an organization is stalling is saying, oh yeah, let's just give it one of our slow moving task forces. And then they're going to come up with a report. Report's going to look really good. We'll see the report in 9 to 12 months. Forget it. Just forget it.
Is that the case that sometimes when people assemble into these task forces, they have no real power or decision-making authority when it comes to change? So therefore, if they have no power, then change can happen. And it's everything's being fed up the chain. And then they're going, no, don't like what I see. Gone.
Yeah. So please don't put your organization through it. If you don't have the power to instigate change, work on influencing the people who do have the power. Don't give work to people for the work that's never going to actually be used, because that work got put on their calendars. They're doing things. They became invested, and it's not going to matter. That's like an unkind thing to do.
So let's move to Tuesday then. So Tuesday is all about solving for trust. If an organization has an issue with trust, or has trust wobbles, as you say, what are the things that happen in an organization that erodes trust?
First, I want to say that if I have lost organizationally, if we have lost trust, which is the same as individually, if we have lost trust, if you are skeptical, it's only ever for one of three reasons. So the only reasons that if there's a breakdown in trust, we can always, always, always trace it back to you doubt my authenticity or my logic or my empathy. So it's this Tuesday heavily relies on the fact that we know the three pillars of trust. And that simplifies the world so much. If you don't have that underlying schematic, Tuesday could take forever. But with that underlying schematic, wherever trust is broken, first thing to do is identify, is it authenticity, logic, or empathy? And the reason it's important is that the prescriptions are entirely different. So you need, now the good news, there's only three, there's not four. But they're very, very different. And then we can tell you, you know, like what are common ways that it does it. So the most common logic challenge, and we always call it a wobble, the most common logic wobble. And we call it a wobble because we want you to, first of all, we want you to know it's shaky and it's not, and we can steady it. And it's also a little playful. It's not like overly severe. But the main logic wobble that organizations have is that they have succumbed to shiny object syndrome. And that is they just keep saying yes to things and never say no to anything. And then they're over the amount of time needed to do their set of tasks exceeds 100%. That means that they have no realistic chance of delivering on their promises. So that's a capability, problem when I, and the capability problem is within logic. And so a lot of the logic problems are really, what am I going to do and what am I not going to do? And so if I have shiny object syndrome or if I have an aversion to making choices, that's going to show up as I'm not capable of delivering on the value propositions that I have promised to people.
Does that mean that it has to be, from an organizational point of view and the leadership point of view, some strategic trade-offs that need to be made?
Oh, yeah. So strategy is within logic for the most part. So look, if I'm not making strategic trade-offs, and I'm just saying to everybody, go do as many different things as you can, as however many hours you have in the day, go do as many different things as you can. That's organization A. And organization B is, we're going to do these two things, and we're going to use all our hours in the day to be better at these two things than everyone else. Which one do you think is going to win? Right? Organization B is going to win. We would say that organization A has a logic wobble. And that's one that's very heavily rooted in, to your point, not making the strategic trade-offs, not making the strategic choices.
And do you think then sometimes when strategic trade-offs are not made, there's somewhat a disconnect between the people who are carrying out the tasks and doing the work and people making the decisions?
It's maddening to the people that are doing the work. So when we talk to the people that are making the decisions, and they're like, oh yeah, you know, everything is important. And we're like, go now talk to the front line. And when you say everything is important, their lives are miserable. Give them clarity so that they can, all of their efforts are value added. So ambiguity at the top is just creating a really bad job for people on the front line.
And that's why people tend to be cynical then about change. It's like nothing ever changes. It's just constant, yeah.
Nothing ever changes.
It's constant demands, isn't it?
And constant uncertainty. And change efforts should be providing clarity, not uncertainty.
There's a part of me thinking then, if I want to build back up trust, is that something where I tell it by a story, which we'll tell later on, or if it's so damaged about, you talked about the authenticity and the logic and the empathy. Does that mean that there should be a change of leadership? You know, what does it depend on context or?
Yeah. So I'll tell you, in all of the work we've done, we've had to, very few people have to be changed out. It's usually some, but very few. For example, when we went to Uber, they had 13,000 employees. And in June of 2017, we swapped out 20. So I just want to, 20 out of 13,000. And I think that's the order of magnitude where it's the individuals that are the problem. So by and large, the people have the capability to do this. They just haven't received the appropriate secret memo in how to do it. And this book is the secret memo on how to do it.
And is there other pitfalls then, you know, trust pitfalls that people, you know, succumb to?
Oh, yes, there are. And in fact, I'm sure if I opened up my book, I would I would see them.
So we have two here.
Yeah, tell me your favorite one and I'll respond to it.
Well, I like the shiny object that you talked about, but the one I like is the reliance on heroic employees. And these people become bottlenecks, and these are the fabric of the organization that become heavily relied on. And in my experience, these people then are the people who are shielding, I suppose, bad decision makers from the consequences of their decisions.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. And so on the one hand, thank you. You saved us from delivering a bad service to the customer right in front of us, for example. But oh goodness, we have to make you obsolete because you also stopped us from improving. So if we can't surface problems, we can't improve. And heroic employees help to sublimate problems due to their heroic efforts. So when you are relying on heroic efforts, your organization is not improving at a very fast rate.
And if you have a cohort then of these gatekeepers, and we'll talk about that later on, where these people actually play a real role and service in the organization, once they leave then, and a whole slew of people leave, then the organization starts to really go into major problems.
So what we want is, we don't want there to be individual heroics. We want there to be systemic heroic, right? And otherwise known as improvement. So, and again, people do what they're incented to do. And we probably celebrated the heroic individuals. Oh, you stayed late. You were here over the weekend. You know, we're like, thank you, thank you, thank you. No, no, no. Celebrate the people that are improving the systems with the same fervor as we were celebrating the people that were solving it by any means necessary, but really unwittingly, they're not bad people, but they were denying us the opportunity to systematically improve so that other people could do a better job. We know that they can do it by any means necessary, but what I want is that we can do it with ordinary excellence. And any means necessary gets in the way of ordinary excellence.
There was another one, Francis, that really identified with, and I see it quite commonly, and that's why I'm going to discuss it, is the people pleasing in boardrooms. There's a lot of pressure in boardrooms, and maybe I'm not sure what's driving it at sometimes.
Well, I can tell you, so from being on boards, if you ask me what is the number one thing that makes boards of directors crazy, it's when management comes in and is trying to say what they think the board wants to hear, and is trying to only give good news, and is trying to do all this people pleasing. It makes boards of directors crazy, because we can sniff out that there is something going on, but we don't know specifically what. And yet, so many management teams think, oh, it's the board. Let's make sure we, you know, don't tell them too much, or we frame it this way. Whereas the best thing, management teams the world over, the best thing you can do is tell the board your problems so that they can help you solve them. Don't pretend that your problems are actually not that bad. And that's going on so much. So people pleasing in the boardroom, we call it an authenticity wobble, because the boards of directors are wondering, well, what else are you not telling us if you're not telling us this? And then it's hard for us to trust you. So this one, I think, is really big. And I don't know why that secret memo of tell boards what you think they want to hear, I don't know where that memo came from. It does so much damage. I've never met a board of directors that wants to hear fake good news. Never, never, never. And yet, I see so many management teams thinking their job is to tell as positive a spin as possible on the stories. No spin. No spin. Is tell us the truth, and we'll be helpful. If you've assembled a good board, they'll be helpful to you. And if they can't be helpful, then you haven't assembled a good board, and reassemble.
That really goes back into what you were saying earlier on, the authenticity, the logic, and the empathy. Some people are kind of going, who made that decision? what was the logic behind it? So again, everything you're saying here, I suppose, falls into those three. And then I love this quote in the book from Robert McDonald. Organizations are perfectly designed to get the results they get. If you don't like the results, change the design. I think it's a brilliant statement.
Yes. And it just strips it away to its utter simplicity, which is that our outcomes are reliable. And if you don't like the direction we're pointed in, point in a different direction.
So when it comes about design, then part of it could be strategy. Another part could be your organizational design. It could be, you know, there's many different facets to that, isn't there?
Yes. Yeah.
In your experience, then, you know, when you go in and you're trying to help an organization, you start with asking all the right questions as well. Is there an element there where people are not being listened to, you know, in different parts of the business? So I know there's a turtle parable in the book. Maybe you want to tell our listeners about that.
Gloria Steinem. Yes, this is so good. So good. Which is when she was in college and doing something brought her to the river of the, to the bed of the Connecticut River. And she saw a turtle that she thought was trying to climb out of the river. And so she picked it up and carried it to what she thought was safety. And then only to be told by her instructor that that turtle had probably spent a month trying to get where it did. And what she learned from that, but not till many years later upon reflection, was always ask the turtle. Don't assume you know the direction. You don't assume you know what the turtle needs. Always ask the turtle. And we do so much where we make assumptions and without getting the input. And I think this is a big part of Wednesday and what we call playfully make new friends, but make sure you are talking directly with everyone who has a stake in your problem. So make sure your problem on Monday is big enough to be worthy of the effort. And then on Wednesday, make sure you talk with all of the various stakeholders. And what we see too often is that the senior team will get together with the senior team. So with everyone we've had and we're trying to solve a problem, the problem got created on your watch. Bring in new people. And so we even metaphorically say, bring empty chairs around the table. Point to the empty chairs and say, whose voice is not represented? And don't continue until you have filled up the empty chairs with whose voice is not the front line. Maybe it's suppliers, maybe it's shareholder, whoever it is, make new friends. And bring new voices in. They will give you peripheral vision that is unimaginable.
So say, for example, there are cynical people listening in to this and they're going to go on inclusion, D&I initiatives, you know, all this stuff is just a fad right now. Like, surely there's no competitive business advantages to be involved in this. You know, that's just going to make my life more difficult. What would you say to people who might be thinking that way?
Well, I would say, first of all, I would say you might have come by that honestly, because maybe the way in which it was implemented at your company felt like what we were talking about earlier, which is just the fad of the month, and we didn't really take it seriously, and it just felt like another burden, and I can see where cynicism would creep in. But here's what I would say is underneath it. Think of each person that's listening. Think about how much of your best efforts are represented every day at work. Like, how much does what you're doing at work permit you to be all in and awesome? And how much of you is blocked from full participation, from the organization getting the full benefits of all of your awesomeness? And what we would say is that however much is getting blocked, and by the way, the average Gallup tells us is that 20% of people on average, organizations are getting 20% of the awesomeness of individuals. Just want that number to just sink in. 20, one fifth. Here's what inclusion is. Can we fill that cup? What if we could remove the obstacles so that we had full access to your awesomeness? The reason inclusion is partnered with diversity is there are often demographic tendencies associated with it. So in some organizations, white men might feel like, oh, the organization is getting 80 or 90% of my awesomeness. And Black women might say the organization is getting 10%. And so we're not being inclusive of diverse perspectives. But by the way, I can show you many organizations where white men do not feel like they're walking on eggshells, and they don't feel like they're able to bring their full awesomeness. So what we're saying is get as many perspectives as you can. And some of it'll be lived experience, but some of it'll be like, you know, people that have failed before, people who have learned from failure, people who are lucky enough to have neurodiversity. Like, get as many perspectives as you can, and then remove all the obstacles to full engagement. And when you can do that, you can thump the competition. Thump the competition. So I have no idea how DEI was done in your organizations, but maybe wasn't done with that level of optimism and that level of competitive advantage. Maybe they made you attend an unconscious bias training, which can be grim, to be honest with you, and is scarcely the way to full inclusion.
So speaking of failing, then, you mentioned earlier on in the book about the fail wall. As an Irish person, I was just kind of going, I am just going to interpret that as the wall of shame.
Yes, but not shame, but take away the shame. That's the thing. Here's the thing. If you have failed, and look, if you, like, let's say we're doing something that's unknown, and you could have done it with red or purple. You chose purple, and purple didn't work out. It's not shame. We just got to learn that purple didn't work out. The last thing I want is for everybody else to have to learn on their own watch that purple doesn't work. So make sure we spread it far and wide, that when you learn something the first time, there's no shame associated with it. And that's, I think, so that's why you want it to, the fail wall is proudly showing. It's the same place where you put your trophies. But all the new wonderful learning that occurred, somebody had to go first and guess red or purple. Now, the person who goes second has a much easier job. I'm going to pick that one. I'm going to pick the remaining one. Now, if you tried purple and it didn't work, the only thing I'm not going to put on that wall is if I am behind you, pick purple again. That's actually a wall of shame to me. If we already learned the lesson and you're relearning the lesson, that's a wall of shame. But a pride is you pick purple, and let's make sure we spread far and wide that purple doesn't work for these reasons. The organization is that much closer to excellence.
There is a part there, if there's a culture of learning in an organization and a culture of, you know, learning to fail and celebrate that, that goes all the way up to the boardroom where people can, you know, open and honestly say, we didn't make it and here's why, versus trying to, you know, buffer it in some way or, you know, tell a story in a way that may not be realistic.
All of the boards of directors that I've been involved with and have studied and advised, none of them think that perfection is the reasonable outcome. All of it is iterating and learning. And the only time I've seen these boards frustrated is when there's no iterating and no learning. Learning comes. Now, managers, I find they have severe perfectionist tendencies that we just have to liberate them from. That this notion that if I didn't get it right, I have to pretend I did. No pretending. We didn't have the expectation you would get it right. We have the expectation that you'll be better tomorrow than you are today. So what we care about is rate of improvement, not absolute perfection. In fact, perfectionist tendencies stifle improvement.
And then I mentioned telling a story then, and it's wonderful that you're giving us these messages. So Thursday, I wrote it down here. Today's mission is to tell a story so powerful, so clear and compelling that will unleash your company's energy and channel it in the direction of change. And then I said to myself, no pressure then.
Well, here's what I can, I'll say a couple of things. One is the first draft of a story is not going to achieve what we just said, nor is the second draft and probably not the third draft. So again, let's bring this perfectionist lesson. Write their first draft so that you can be embarrassed by it for the second draft, so that you can be embarrassed by it by the third draft. Iterate the story. So a story is really important because the story exists in your absence. So in my presence, I could tell you things. I can use my like examples. And if I have some charisma, I can use that. So in my presence, you get it. But you walk out the door and you have no idea what just happened. The story is the thing that accompanies us into our absence. So the story has to be so good that it guides what people will do in our absence. So one, realize it takes all day. takes a whole day to do the story. It gets its own day. That's the first thing. And then the second thing is that stories, there's structures of stories that work. So stories have a past, present, and future. And you have to work with the past, present, and futures, and there's ways to do it. But the overriding thing is understand your story so deeply that you can describe it simply. And I think it was Mark Twain that said, "I apologize for writing a long letter. I didn't have time to make it a short letter." This is the mistake we make with communication all the time. Think of all the long emails you get. They should all have on the bottom, "I apologize for writing a long email. I didn't have the time to edit it to make it a short email." This is the problem with many stories, is that we aren't honoring the need for describing simply. And so what we do is we take our, we don't raise the bar on how deeply we have to understand things. The pinnacle of understanding something is that you can finally describe it simply. Along the way, you can't describe it simply. That's why you have to revise. But when you can describe it simply, that can accompany people in your absence. And that is what facilitates fast action.
And again, in your book, then there's many different ways of telling a story. And then you were talking about honoring the past. So some good stuff and maybe the not so good stuff. So there's some wonderful examples there. So, and sometimes people avoid telling, you know, painful past histories, which is again coming more and more common. So here's one thing, is when there's change management going on or change happening, is there will always be self-appointed gatekeepers who are resistant to change. So to bring these gatekeepers along, reassure them that all the parts within us, make it clear to them you will preserve what's best about the company.
Yes. So because you said that sometimes when we honor the past, we have to honor what was, listen, if we're changing, there was something wrong with the past. Right. Now, there are some people who will consider that a organizational version of being unpatriotic. How dare you suggest there was something wrong? I'm not suggesting that it was all wrong. But if there wasn't anything wrong, we wouldn't have any need to change. So we have to say, yeah, here was wrong. But in order for the gatekeepers to feel assured, tell us the vast majority of things that were not changing because they were awesome. So if you just focus on what was wrong, I think you don't see us. You don't have any idea all of the good. And I'm afraid you're going to throw out the good in your quest to fix the bad. So it's really important to honor the good part of the past and the parts that we can be better at. And again, the whole goal of this is to be better tomorrow than we are today. So we find that some people only honor the good and some people only honor the bad. And what often happens is when outsiders come in, we fear that they aren't going to honor the good. And when insiders get promoted to lead change, we feel that they're only that, we feel like the outsiders are only going to honor the bad, that the outsiders are going to say, here's what's wrong, and I'm going to come in and be the savior. Everybody's like, slow down. But the insiders are going to be like too in touch with, this is how we've always done it, so it's good. No. That's just how we've always done it. It may or may not be good. So we really need to have fresh eyes on this so that we can honor both sides. And then let's have a clear idea of, if we were wildly better, like let's make sure we're sold on, if we could fix whatever the problems are we have, is that world different enough to be worth the effort? And let's then focus on that. Anne and I often refer to this as adding a zero. So if you're selling 100 widgets, what if we could fix it so you could sell 1,000? You're selling 1,000 widgets. What if we could make it to 10,000? Now, all of a sudden, nobody's worried about the fatigue of change. We're like, oh my gosh, that's worth it. Make sure what we're doing is worthy. And if we were selling 100, tell us what was really good about how we got to 100 and what needs to change. Act like you see all of it, because only then will you be in a position to change the bits that need to be changed.
There's an example then from Harvard's Business School's historic treatment of women, and a statement that was made where women had felt disrespected, left out, and unloved by the school. I think that was a really powerful thing for the dean to say.
That made everyone in the room felt seen because they had been disrespected and unloved. And to pretend otherwise would make me think, you don't get us. Now, they weren't only disrespected and unloved, but there were significant parts of a significant number of women for which that was the case. So acknowledge it and also acknowledge what has been awesome. And now let's collectively get to a better place.
I think that's some really useful advice. And then there's different examples to tell your story. So that one by SAS, where the CEO did it by a comic book. Brilliant idea.
It's so good. It's called The Red Book. And we now, I have to say that we have used these comic books. The thing I like about a comic book, if you can tell your change story in a comic book, you have understood it so deeply. So comics are the most beautiful description of describe simply. Right? It's with some words and lots of pictures, but pow, you get it. Well, comics are not written quickly, right? Like that's somebody understanding so deeply what they want to communicate. They hone it, and then they can describe it simply. So if you can describe your change initiative, your big change initiative in a comic strip, in a comic book, I believe you understand it really well. And Jan Carlson at SAS Airlines was the one who made that so powerful. But we have comic books now in every language for every industry and they're the testament. And some organizations don't understand it well enough to get to describe it that simply. So they have to describe it in 80-page memos. I can tell you which one's has a higher probability of success.
Or a higher probability of being read.
Well, and thus being successful. Right. If you don't even read it, what's the chance you're going to be able to successfully act on it? I'm going to go ahead and call that zero.
So let's move to Friday then, because we're coming to the end of the podcast. So this is where you go fast as you can. So what gets in the way of us going as fast as we can?
Well, and I want to say that if organizations that move Friday to earlier in the week, they risk reckless disruption. So when we say move fast and fix things, you don't move fast until Friday. And I think that's really important. You're now in a position to move fast. Now, what gets in the way of moving fast? Oh, there are some classic things. But one, and we've touched on them, trying to be great at everything. Fool's errand. We need ruthless prioritization so that we know what to work on and what to give up. That's one thing. We're working on too many projects, right? That's its cousin. What else gets in the way? We want to fast track a project, but we have no mechanism to put something at the front of the line. So everything just has to wait in line. And so that's often called, there's usually a healthcare metaphor, but how do you ambulance a project? How do you give a project the right of way because it needs to be done faster? So there are all of these organizational things. And then I'd say maybe the most important one of all of these is that if we're changing something and something hasn't gone well, people were involved, trust was broken, and there's probably conflict. So high-performing organizations, this is a underappreciated fact. High-performing organizations have loads of conflict. High-performing organizations have situations, problems are complex, reasonable people disagree. Conflict is part of a high-performing organization. And as a human species, we don't really lean into conflict. The human species, we try to lean away from conflict. And so hiding from conflict slows down many an organization. And so we have to lean in to conflict, realize it's good. The problem is so complicated that reasonable people can disagree. Let's lean in and let's work through the conflict. We're going to get to such a better idea versus, oh my gosh, there's conflict, so let's avoid it. That avoidance slows down so many organizations.
And when you go back then to the authenticity and the logic and the trust wobble and the empathy that we talked about, there is a fear of conflict and there's conflict avoidance going on. And that's the work, isn't it?
And what we want to do is give people the knowledge and we've gotten to see this in many times. So you might be doing it for the first time, but we've seen it done hundreds of thousands of times across individuals. So we have the benefit of pattern matching, and we're trying to give you the confidence that comes from that. But in the absence of knowing what to do, start doing something. So the can-do spirit of progress is made in motion. Pro- progress is not made while we're sitting and reflecting and waiting. There's nothing going on then. Get into action. And if this problem is not one worthy of action, take it off everybody's calendar and let them only do the things that are worthy of action. That's the challenge, is we put so many things on our calendar that we don't think are worthy of action, but they're taking up the most precious resource we have in the organization, which is other people's time. So I guess the last thing I would say is this book is written in part because we have been appalled at the calendars of executives in organizations. They are so filled, like no one who organizes for peak performance would say, oh, that calendar, that's designed for peak performance. It's designed for mediocrity at best. There's no slack in the system. Everything is equally important. It's back to back to back to back. That is no way to live, but that's what happens if we don't prioritize, if we just let no idea is a bad idea, if we try to be great at everything. So if you're wondering, do you need to change? Look at your calendars. That'll tell you.
So there's a part in the book about fast-tracking projects. And I want to go back to that schedule piece that you were talking about there. I am fascinated by people who do this back-to-back approach. Like, how much of your diary should have the capacity to fast track a project? Should it be 20%, you know, or what should it be?
People who understand the need for slack for peak performance. So I'm going to subset a world. So part of the world thinks, oh, you have slack, I should fill it. You have empty space, I should fill it. So we're not talking about them. They are sub-optimizing. But the people who realize you need white space in order to have peak performance. For that subset of the world, I don't know anyone who thinks that the white space should be less than 50%.
So 20 hours a week, and there are people kind of going, they're scratching their heads, kind of going, that's never going to happen in my organization. If people were...
Yeah, here's what I would say to those people. Look back at last week's meetings. Look back at last month's meetings. In retrospect, did you not have to be at half of them? Would your life have been any different had you not been at half of them? And I am certain the same people who are saying, I can't possibly do it, also are attending non-value-added meetings. We are inviting too many people to too many meetings that are too unstructured. We're not getting peak performance. And the cost of that is the most precious resource we have at our organization, which is other people's time. So one of the things we try to get people to think about is, what if other people's time was the most precious resource you had in your organization? Now, how would you design?
So next time I'm going to a meeting, I'm going to ask myself, will this change my life?
And here's what I'd like you to do. The next time you set a meeting, have you designed it so that it has the chance of changing the life of everyone who's attending?
That is a powerful statement. And this is a powerful book. And Frances, if people were to find more about you and more about your book, how might they do so?
I find that LinkedIn is the best place to interact. And so I think that if you connect with me and connect with Anne, so it's Frances Frei, it's Frances with an E, F-R-E-I, and then connect with Anne Morris, and she has so many extra letters, A-N-N-E-M-O-R-R-I-S-S. Like, I mean, just put in all of the extra ones. But connect with us on LinkedIn. That we have very active communities there. We're constantly putting up things for discussion. If you want to learn more, that's a great place to start.
Frances Frei, you have been wonderful today. Thank you so much for taking the time to join the Workplace Podcast today.
And thank you. You know, you cherished the book. The listeners can't see. You win by having the most stickies in a book, for having, I think some of the pages are even at risk of falling out. You've worked with them so much. It's such a pleasure to talk with someone who has so clearly cherished the work. So thank you for that.
Thank you for listening to the podcast with your host, William Corliss, in association with Enterprise Ireland. Our special thanks to the episode's guests for sharing their expertise with us. For our upcoming podcast, please follow our website, www.enterprise-ireland.com. Enterprise Ireland, helping Irish business go global.